Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 279 featuring Mike with Eric from Unity. And Mike is a really cool guy. He is, what's his title, Kristen?
He's head of tech, media, and entertainment.
Yes, he is really cool. I got introduced to him through our good friend Ian Spriggs, and Ian and Mike worked. They weren't working at the same company, but they were working on the same project or working together over at Oats, which was pretty interesting. He is basically like, he kind of has like the R&D cool stuff that that my job has, but he has it over at Unity, which is kind of a fun thing for him to do. We actually recorded this podcast a while ago, so I'm sorry for the delay in getting it out. It was actually at the very beginning of us going into isolation, so that, you know, like sometime in March. So apologize for it taking so long to come out. We don't actually have video of that. This is before we were recording video, but we're still going to put a video YouTube out there just to keep consistency. But it's pretty cool that Mike was on. What were some of the cool things that you liked about it, Kristen?
It was like interesting listening, kind of the game engine is being used for visual effects, ArcViz and all the automotive industries now. And you guys also talk about how like the techniques and tools from filmmaking and gaming are merging to like help create like the projects. Like you guys talk a lot about Lion King and then Oats Studios, their Adam series. So it was just an interesting to learn about all that.
Yeah, it's really cool. I really like Mike's attitude also. I mean, he actually comes from the gaming industry. Before he was even part of Unity, he was just sort of trying to develop his own game engine and doing a bunch of other things, and then sort of talked about how Unity came about. We did really kind of get into the history of game engines and when the real pinnacle change happened, which I thought was really fascinating, including the sort of the arrival of the iPhone and how the iPhone kind of changed the gaming industry completely, in terms of it used to cost a lot of money to license a game engine, and then it became free all of a sudden. So that was thanks to Unity. And that sort of pushed everything that happened in the app world, which is pretty cool. So now, as you mentioned, Kristen, the big trend is to actually put the game engines into products that aren't necessarily games, yeah. Which is kind of cool.
So cool.
We have a couple of announcements. What's going on?
All right. So you can find about all this at chaosgroup.com. Our big one is V-Ray 5 for Maya. Beta is now available, and you can test that out.
For those of you who wanted this, you who wanted it, it's now out. So I know you guys are a lot of envious of the people on the Max world who've been having the beta for a while, but now the Maya one is out, which is super exciting. Where can they find that? I guess just at V-Ray, chaosgroup.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there's another one?
Yes, the V-Ray 5 for 3DS Max beta is still available. So you can try that. You just go to our website and try it out.
Yes, and the official product will be coming out eminently, very, very soon. Mm-hmm. So definitely keep checking at chaosgroup.com for announcements of when the release version is coming out, as well as some really other exciting announcements that are going to be happening this week. So definitely check those out, because there's going to be a lot of fun things and things that you may be interested in learning about it. So check back often at chaosgroup.com for all of that information. And then in terms of the podcast, where can people follow us, Kristen?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And of course, if you have any ideas of other podcasts you'd like to have, well, hopefully they won't be as delayed as the one we have with Mike. And my apologies, Mike. Still relevant information, by the way. Still relevant information. But if you ever have any ideas, please let us know. You can always email us with all of your ideas, labs@chaosgroup.com, and we will always appreciate any information you have there. And of course, you guys all know about reviews. We love reviews. So go check us out. Apple Podcast. Just go there and put in a rating and a review. Share us, of course, there. And remember that we are also available on YouTube now. So just go to the Chaos Group TV channel on YouTube, and you can watch all the podcasts live. Like I said, Mike was not recorded live, but we'll still put it up on YouTube for consistency. But we have other episodes that definitely have video as well, so you guys can check those out. And we will be continuing to do videos in future podcasts as well. All right. That being said, please enjoy this incredible podcast with Mike from Unity.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I met you through Ian Spriggs, right? And so you and Ian were both, you were not working for Unity, I mean, not working for Oats, but you were working at Oats for under Unity to work on the Atom shorts, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was the sort of the on-site tech producer for Unity.
Okay.
Working with them, helping them navigate the world of real time for the first time.
Okay. So once you sort of did that, and that was sort of, was that your introduction to working in the film world from the game stuff? Because we'll go back to your game stuff a little bit, but was that the first time you had done that?
Yeah, it was actually, again, I joined Unity served as to help them launch the timeline tool, which is their nonlinear editor. And that was really my first sort of experience of what, like, I'd done video editing and various other things in the past, but this was suddenly taking the real-time world that I was so familiar with and applying that layer of creating animations and building the actual full productions. And then Oats was the first, at least at that scale, project that I'd worked on. And I think even Unity had done the original Atom short, but that was still pretty experimental. Even inside Unity, I think to this day, a lot of people don't really fully understand how we do as linear animation with Unity.
Okay.
It's a game engine.
It's not the same philosophy, right?
It's not the same philosophy. And it's a very different way of organizing your projects, organizing your content. How do you actually come up with a movie out of a game engine? It's a foreign concept to a lot of people.
Although there are similarities with cinematics, but it's not quite the same, right?
Absolutely, yes. And that was sort of the original, I think, intention behind Timeline, was actually allowing people to create just sequencing anything. You're sequencing animations and audio and for cinematics. And then we just, for things like the Oats shorts, we kind of took that to it's extreme level, where let's try to make a feature film quality CG movie with a tool that like this.
Right. So to give people a little bit of a backstory again, so I'm sorry we have to repeat it, but let's go back. You said you started sort of in the late 90s, early 2000s is when you started to get into games stuff, right? And you were interested in game engines more specifically, or game?
I've been programming since I was 12. So that's going back to like even way further than that. But it was the late 90s when suddenly 3D became a thing, really, where you could actually do 3D in real time versus like the traditional 2D engines.
Doom and Quake. Yep.
The Quake 2. And that also started unlocking a lot of the tools for mere mortals, like the modding community. So the Quake editors, the even going back like Doom editors and all those kind of things. Suddenly, as a person not working in the industry, I could suddenly get access to some of the same tools that the pros were using.
Right.
So that was really the tipping point for me. And then because of id's amazing philosophy of being very open source and kind of sharing with the community, that really helped, I think, introduce this whole generation to, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to work in this world.
Right. Well, it was, I remember, I mean, I think I was in grad school when I was playing some of those games, and it was kind of amazing to think about it. And then the first thing, you know, I was in grad school, but I was also in architecture school. And so to me, it was like, wait a minute, I can build my whole school or my whole building inside of this engine. It was like the first realization that I had that could be a possibility. But then I realized that something very important, especially at that time, is that the actual rendering engine, the real-time rendering engine, was actually something you if you were working at an architecture company, you had to purchase that. You couldn't just make a Doom level and hand it to your client and say, here's a walkthrough of your building. You
actually
had to buy the engine, right? And the engines were like at that time, like $500,000 or something crazy like that.
They used to call it the middleware market at that point was very different than what it is nowadays. And you would have middleware for just about everything, like physics and animation and audio. And you as like the big AAA studios would kind of purchase or all of these separate modules and then
write them all themselves.
That was the other option. And have an army of engineers either merging all these things, trying to get them to play nice, or write your own custom tools.
Right.
So as a one person indie, it was kind of this walled garden that I couldn't see into until these tools started becoming available either through the open source world, or the modding community. Those are sort of the two avenues essentially. So that's really how I got into sort of working in this space professionally, was through the open source side of things. Found a project called Genesis 3D and really dove into it, started becoming very involved in that community, started helping, got involved with a team that was building some tools on top of Genesis 3D. Mm-hmm. And then ended up making a studio on top of that with a buddy of mine from high school. He was the business guy. I was the tech guy.
And this is what, like 2001 or so?
I think we incorporated officially in 2003. So
there you go.
I had been doing it for a few years before that until I finally convinced him that it was a thing that we should do.
Okay.
And then, 2003 till about 2008, 2009-ish is when we made a run for it. At the time, it was us, Garage Games, and Unity. Unity came, version 1 came out around 2005. We actually met them at GDC. We had a booth at GDC at that time, like one of the small 10 by 10 booths that cost $1 billion still, but it was like all of our money for the year we put in. And Joachim and I think it was Joachim and David came up and they're like, do you like our, they had their Gooball version 1.0 demo. They're like, do you like our demo?
And
I'm keep my eye on you.
Right.
And then, they kind of took off. It was really around 2000, whatever, the iPhone, 2007, 2008.
Right.
I think if you actually looked at...
2007 is when it came out. And then when the App Store opened up and everyone started making games and first it was the big round of, fart apps and beer drinking apps that were there. And then when suddenly people was like, no, I can make a very simple game and then make it work on this. And that's, I think, Unity was like the tool of choice to just make a game and just make it work.
No, exactly. They were one of the first of these, like the game engines. And I think they were the first to actually support publishing on the App Store.
Right.
And if you look at the revenue, I think it was like pretty flat. Like we were all kind of like creeping along and then it just like skyrocketed once the iPhone came out.
But let's think about this. Let's go back a little bit, because the business model is very interesting to me. Because like I said, it used to be $500,000 to get around to get an engine to do. Unity is quote unquote free, right? So you can just go in and use it if you want to, et cetera, et cetera. It's the moment you start monetizing your product that they start to take a revenue. How does it work exactly?
Let's rewind back to actually the history of it. So going from $1 million to where they were at, I think. So we had these... There was these upstart indie engines. Garage Games was one. They had they actually had the Tribes 2 engine they managed to get rights for. So there was multiple of these engines that suddenly had an indie version that was like $100. Unity originally was $100. There was no free version or anything. So it was $100 and then that was what you paid. And I think it was under 100K revenue or something. It was meant for individuals. That went along, and then the iPhone came out and exploded. All of the tools, like our tool, Unity, Garage Games, had this professional edition, which was the trying to figure out how to make more money. So we had like $1,500. The iPhone came out, and suddenly there was an actual reason why you wanted that professional edition. Whereas we were all struggling trying to figure out like what would justify
who's going
to
buy that?
What's going to justify a jump from $100 to $1,500? That's either going to be a whole bunch of new features or something magic. And none of us had figured it out until suddenly this iPhone version came out for Unity.
Right.
So their revenue just went through the roof after that. And I think they went from like 10 people to 50 to 100, whatever. And it kind of just started growing from there.
Well, the thing that was interesting also, especially in the game market, is that, that, you know, games used to cost $60 or whatever, right? They were expensive, you know, to get a video game. Still are, you know, if you buy a game on any platform, a PC or whatever, but on the iPhone, suddenly it's like 99 cents, yeah. Right? Yeah. And then we're $1.99, and people are like, this game is $3.99. That's too expensive, which is ridiculous to think about it. But the user base was massive. Yes. Massive, right? People were just impulse buying games like nonstop.
Well, so, especially when it was the massive swell of users, but there was so few titles. So the developers who got into those in on the early side were able to just make massive revenue as a result.
Sure.
That obviously has changed, where now you're getting tens of thousands of games on the store every day and whatever. But anyways, yeah, so Unity had been kind of chugging along at doing their iPhone thing, and then they decided to go free. And that literally, I think, destroyed the entire middleware market at that
point.
That was when I decided, okay, I can't fight free. I don't know how to fight free. At least I didn't have the means at the time. Thinking back, maybe there were some things I could have done, but it was at the point where I was like, okay, can't beat them, join them. And I literally kind of effectively kind of finished off what I was doing with my company, and then became a Unity developer. So, and at that point, it was, this was like, 2009. 2010, DNA is a big studio in Japan. They were starting up a Vancouver studio, so I joined that one as like employee 2 or 3.
Okay,
And this was
the Vancouver area.
In Vancouver, So they were trying to expand globally, and helped grow that studio till about 50, 60 people.
Yep.
That was a very interesting moment, because the Japanese mobile world was very, like, a lot more sophisticated than the rest of the mobile world. Japan's a kind of a unique market, because it's all one time zone. So it's like such a narrow pocket of people all in one time zone. So things like the things that are standard now for most games, like live operations, running games as a service, was very easy to do when you have one time zone. You want to update your game, you just update it at midnight because nobody's playing. Or like 2 in the morning. Whereas trying to do a game as a service for like Fortnite, where it's 24 hours a day, it's a much more challenging operation.
Yeah, and multiple servers around the world.
Exactly. So DNA they've become very successful in Japan, and then we're trying to figure out how to scale globally. This is actually what a lot of studios have tried to do. They become successful in one territory, they want to expand. It was actually a lot more challenging for DNA than they expected, but that's another story we know to talk about. But after that, I actually kind of left games for a short period of time, and went to work for a online website company. It's doing kind of just web development. It was, but the interesting thing for that was it allowed me to really get into large scale deployment of software, like dealing with millions of users. And I've had this weird career where I'm kind of all over the place, but it is actually a very similar set of skills that are needed.
Sure. But it must have been very different from the indie game market, right? When suddenly you're thinking about that. I mean, what are the biggest difference between large scale game development versus indie game development? Because I'm sure there's a lot of differences.
Well, a lot of it is just the content that's needed. So that's the complexity in the content. Mobile, though, what we did for DNA was it's all live operated games. So it's not just a game you download and it's a static thing. It's a dynamically updated game. So this is every time you launch it, it talks to the server and actually grabs the updates, grabs new content. This is actually much more like what happens in a big AAA game nowadays. They were just kind of ahead of the curve. So you launch Fortnite every morning, or my kids do it every day. Right. Now that we're on a break, kids launch Fortnite. It downloads the newest version of the game.
And sometimes that can take an hour. Well, depending on the internet. Yeah.
Depending on the internet and the size of the game. So the size of the updates, I think, will vary. But it's this live operated service model is the way that most content, I think, will be delivered going forward. Even potentially to the point of like TV and movies, if we start looking at more interactive content or dynamically delivered content.
Yeah.
There was the jokes on the internet where Cats got a day one patch, the movie, when it came out, because they wanted to update it to the theaters. So
yes.
So that's a whole, like, to extrapolate 15 years in the future where everything is real time.
Well, that just, I mean, so when I started in film, I mean, doing visual effects, right, we had to, like, there was a hard deadline because they would have to print the reels that go out, and there were literally films that, you know, that would go out. And so sometimes if you really, really wanted to push it, you would prioritize, because they would literally have reels, like five reels of film that would go out to the movie theater. You would prioritize and delay the last reel just enough to finish the few shots that you'd have on that reel.
Yeah.
And that was about as much as you could push it. Nowadays,
yeah,
a film is delivered.
Digital delivery.
Yeah. Now it's an FTP download, you know, so it's like, and it plays live from the theater that way. And it's kind of insane. That was just nowadays it's. And you can patch it, which is insane.
Yeah. And even think of like a Netflix style delivery model where it's only being streamed to you when you hit go. It could be being patched or changed up till that moment, or potentially dynamically while you're
right. They did. Didn't they do that on Game of Thrones? And they found, like, everyone was joking because they found a Starbucks cup.
Sure they did. Yeah.
And then they patched it. And it's really easy to patch. It's just a little paint out. But, you know, nonetheless, it's like it got fixed. So you can't actually find that version, right?
No, exactly. when you look at the mix of what they do and like what games typically do, it's actually, or one challenge, I guess the analogy would be, film localization or the regionalization, all of the changes that they have to do to a movie when you're looking at different zones around the world.
Yes.
Suddenly, if you could apply dynamic changes, like with a real-time engine or something, suddenly that idea of what is a movie becomes a fluid thing.
Nice. Yeah.
so you don't have to bake out those 15 or 300 languages that you have to make your movie in. It could be just dynamically updated for CG movies. You could do dynamic lip sync. You could dynamically change the billboards or the street signs or who knows where this is all going. But a lot of the technological pieces are starting to become readily available now.
Yeah. So that's interesting. I was just I'm just trying to figure out, like, how did we get to this part? And it's like, yes, that's right. we were talking about you know, working from an indie studio to the big studio and some of the lessons.
Totally, yeah. It's just what indie studios do is the very scrappy kind of do it however you need to.
Sure.
So they've been able to innovate in a lot of ways that a big studio maybe can't, because it's just like big movies. There's so much money on the line. You can't really take a lot of risks. You have to go for the safe bet. Indie games has always been fascinating in that regard, whether it's new models or new gameplay styles or new genres. You can take risks that the big players can't. I've always loved sort of the indie movies for the same reason, or indie media in general, whether it's music or whatever. You always find the most interesting experiments going on outside of the fringes.
I think that's the point of indie, right? It's like, I've got an idea and that I want to try that no one else took the risk to do, and I'm gonna put my own skin in the game and figure out if that's going to work or not. Right. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, just look at the Angry Birds guys. Right. So how many games did they come up with before suddenly they said, well, let's try this one. And then that one took off for some reason, you know?
Yeah, no, I think it was in the upwards of 50, 60 games that had 50, launched 60 and games. Fails. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And then you, like, if you look at, go back to the Oats idea, that's exactly what Neil was trying to do in that model is trying to do something outside of the traditional sort of Hollywood world, try out, like that's what his volume one shorts was trying out as many ideas as he could, get as many kicks at the can as possible. Yep. It's very similar model. I think it's a fascinating time to be a creator because of the sophistication of the tools and business model opportunities. And yeah, it's interesting times.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about this for quite a bit now, but I really want to know, like, okay, so let's see. When you walked into that studio, walked into Oates, and you saw, you know, obviously Neil Blomkamp has created some big films that have been very successful, visually stunning, has a very specific style. There's a specific genre that he enjoys doing as well. Mm-hmm. That's very, you know, Blomkamp. He's not doing, you know, Pride and Prejudice type movies, right? But he is doing something very interesting, right? And so a lot of character stuff and a lot of interesting things. He's obviously tried to look at a shift in filmmaking and, you know, a different way of doing film and a different way of approaching things. And he experimented a lot with Oates. And obviously one of the things that he did, obviously, with the Adam stuff was he was looking at real-time concepts and virtual production concepts. So what were – and you had mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that that was something that you guys were sort of thought about or were considering, but it seems like that was the first time you really put a massive thing to the test in some ways, right?
Yeah, Unity has a team internally out of Stockholm. It's internally just called the demo team. And they actually created the original Adam. They created a few other things. Yeah. There was a Viking short sort of various before. They did also more recently The Book of the Dead and The Heretic. So they've always been trying to push the limits of the technology. What was unique about the Oates experiment was that this was not Unity trying to do it. So this wasn't us eating our own dog food. This was like handing the tools to an external team who had never used it before and seeing what they could create. And it was so it was particularly fascinating in that regard. I've specifically about working with Oates, like I've been a huge fan of his movies from like back to his original like commercial work that he had done, just kind of his CG or the VFX soup, Chris Harvey as well. He's both of them had been very eager and interested in working in real time. They were actually a Redshift studio previously, so they'd already sort of been experimenting with GPU compute, trying to actually speed up the iteration times. But it's a similar story we find with a lot of people, is that it's not a big enough of a jump. They had their own mocap facility in the Oates facility in their office. So they had their own, I think it was, I can't remember if it was
Viacom or OptiTrack or one of those.
I think theirs is an OptiTrack actually. So they had their own mocap set up. They actually had they had built their own photogrammetry booth with like 50 cameras that they had somehow duct taped together into a thing to capture all the actors. So they were very good at sort of the scrappy indie version of what a big Hollywood studio does. They had never used Unity. So my team was there to kind of help navigate that water. What exactly it means, best practices. Like best practices is kind of a loose term when you're coming to a lot of this stuff because we're inventing it as we go. And I think anyone who tells you that they know exactly how this works is being a little disingenuous to you because it changes so rapidly. But that was essentially what my team was there to do. It's everything from lighting for real time is very different than lighting for offline rendering. Character design is pretty similar. Again, because they were already using Redshift, they were doing their look dev with Substance. They were doing a lot of the similar things that just came across one for one. So as far as their day-to-day workflow for the team on the floor, it didn't actually change much. The biggest was probably the environment set dressers, where they could actually jump in and set dress live in Unity. And the lighting team could actually get in and place lights and actually have the lights react immediately and not have to send it off to render to see the changes. Those were the biggest, I think, the biggest impact areas.
I remember when I was back in the day when I was working on iRobot, I was one of our supervisors who had never, he came from the modeling, motion control kind of thing. He worked on like Star Trek and all that stuff, but he wanted to know more about CG lighting and how it works. But he was a DP for miniatures. So he knew how to light miniatures, et cetera. And he wanted to say, learn like the process. And he realized like, okay, so you place all these lights and then you wait like 15 minutes to see if that worked. And then you stop it and then do it again. And he goes, that would be like me going on set, moving a bunch of lights around,
going for coffee,
waiting 15 minutes, turning on the lights, see if it worked, then turning them off and then moving them again and then waiting 15 minutes and then turning them on again. It's like, that is ridiculous. It's like, and I was like, yeah. So real time and lighting is obviously a big deal, right?
Yeah,
like
that's, I think, the game changer. That's where it is the biggest game changer for sure.
Sure.
Now, when you start layering in, you mentioned virtual production. So being able actually to pick up a camera and run around, that's the next, I think, biggest impact for as a director, being able to actually see what you're shooting live in a CG world compared to the equivalent back in the day where you have your gray box world and you can't actually see what it is, what it's going to be. There's been so much movement in the last year, even like this is after the Atom shorts were 3 years ago. So in most of the tech world, that's like ancient history, really.
Yeah.
For
virtual production is progressing really, really fast, really fast.
It's not only the virtual production, but just even what is possible with rendering things like RTX and ray tracing is now possible. Unity in particular, our rendering technology is jumped like leaps and bounds since the Atom days.
Right.
Real time, you start combining all of these things where you can get ray traced lights in real time with a virtual camera. I've tied all these things together.
Oh, you don't have to tell me. I work for a ray tracing company. So I'm well aware of that. And in fact, you know, that was something I was thinking about 6 years ago when I did the Construct short, and we were having specifically that issue, right? So we knew we could render really fast. Back then, we didn't have RTX cards. This was 4 or 5 generations before RTX. So the way we achieved RTX is by connecting 32 cards together, and that's how we just moved forth it.
Yeah.
So, but we were able to get basically real-time ray tracing.
Yeah.
The challenge was the only tool we had was Motion Builder at the time, right? Yeah. And so Motion Builder, like you said, it was the gray box world. It was good at capturing data, but it wasn't good at displaying nice data.
Exactly.
And once companies like Unity and Unreal started to get into that filmmaking process, and then it's like, oh, by the way, we also really know how to make things look good, because that's our goal as a game company is to make things look good, not just that's when it became very interesting, obviously, to a good extent. And then obviously ray tracing is still a big part of it, but there's something more than, because I know a lot of people talk about, oh, it looks, the rendering part of it is good, but it's not just the rendering, it's the platform itself. So like, you know, Unity is a platform. It's not just a render. There's a lot of things that Unity can do besides rendering it.
Right? Yeah. And I think that is actually why a lot of people gravitate to Unity is it because it is a platform. You can think of, for animation studios originally, like Maya was the platform that you just built all your technology on. And it just was a nice stable base. Unity serves a similar role, I think, to a lot of studios where it's not only the tech stack itself, you're programming in C#. So you can find people to do the work. The user community is so large. There's millions, literally millions of people out there that know how to build stuff with Unity. The middleware, the third party support, just about anything. Like as a Unity developer, if I need to figure out how to do something, I can Google it and likely find someone who's done it before. As a studio or an individual trying to do something, that's invaluable. Where you can actually tie into this massive community of people. And rely, like, so it kind of like gives you that force multiplier of the community being able to take that and apply it to your specific problem.
Right.
It's definitely not to be underestimated.
Right. Yeah. But there is, but, you know, obviously, you know, we sort of touched on it a little bit before, but Unity was always, you know, was the DNA of Unity as a game company, right?
Yes.
Doing that is a difference between creating a game, which is a first person experience that involves a lot of interaction, et cetera, to telling a story that's a non-linear story and third person experience, right?
Yeah.
So what are some of the lessons that, you know, Unity has learned or changed or created out of their tool set to enable filmmaking to happen in some way through Unity?
Well, I think the biggest core change is the recognition that, like, everything, like you said, Unity was made to make essentially executables. That's what a game is.
Right.
The editor and the executable or the player are two separate things. So the fact that for a film, you're not making players, you're not making executables. The editor is the thing. The editor
right.
is the platform. It is the tool. So recognizing that has been a huge thing. This goes back to even the Atom days, just having proper time codes, proper VSync, being able to actually like have the editor behave as like a first class citizen for our customers. That was a huge change. Just the investment Unity has made as we start getting into some of these non-gaming verticals, the teams are growing every year. We're having more and more engineers dedicated to it. We have actual dedicated graphics teams that are working on features for non-games verticals. In fact,
right.
that's actually where a lot of the ray tracing work comes from, because as much as ray tracing is a nice buzzword, it's not super applicable for games even right now.
Well, not everyone goes out there and buys a $1,000 graphics card.
No, that's the main reason why. It's a nice showpiece, but for say architectural rendering though, that's suddenly a lot more of a thing where a big architecture firm can afford. They will buy the big fancy cards.
Oh, especially if they can do real time ray tracing.
Exactly. the automotive companies when they're doing visualization any of the non gaming ones where you're not dealing with the consumer market, you're dealing with suddenly a business to business sort of market.
Sure.
You can have some of these super high-end requirements like ray tracing. So that's definitely one area. But even when we did the Atom shorts, Unity was not officially doing anything in any non-game verticals. That is a different world to today, where we've actually got official teams dedicated to automotive, to architecture, to engineering, to media and entertainment.
Right.
So,
and you're in the media entertainment group, I'm assuming, right?
Yes. Yeah. So obviously, it's media and entertainment is sort of where my team is. We're actually within Unity's labs group, actually. So,
oh, nice.
Which is Unity's
my group too.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're the labs team at Unity is kind of outside of our product development or our what Unity calls the R&D group. R&D is what develops the actual product and the features for it. Labs is supposed to be that, or the intention is that future looking like 5 to 10 years out, what's the future of X? Whether X is like XR or like VR, AR or
virtual production
or filmmaking or storytelling or AI. These are all things that Unity invests very heavily in. And that's where the labs team under Silvio Druin, that's what that group is doing.
So what's interesting to me is, like, you know, we were talking about filmmaking and all those things and the fact that Unity is a platform. But when you really think about it, Unity is a platform that makes a tool. Right. So like let's start with the fundamentals of the foundation of making a game. A game is a tool. You can think of it as a tool, right?
Yeah.
You start it, you execute it, and you play the game, and it's got controls, and you control it, and you experience the game as whatever it is, right? But because Unity basically makes the tool, you can use Unity to make a tool or a quote unquote a game that makes a movie, right? So you could basically, like, let's do the visual production, right? Let's say you want to say, okay, I want to use Unity. You can use Unity to create all of the cinematography tools that a traditional cinematographer can use, and remove all of the things, the distractions or the complexities that you'd want to hide from that person. So you can basically make custom tools for everyone to use and at their own area of expertise.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. And if you talk to the team that worked on The Lion King, for example.
I know Ben.
Ben and Magnopus, like that's how they describe it, is they basically made a multiplayer game for making movies.
Right.
The DP's got his custom tools. The lighting guy's got his tools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's I actually met with them when they were first starting down that journey, and they explained to me what they were doing. And I just told them they were crazy, because that's like the craziest idea back then. But that's exactly what they've done. And it's, I think that is really where filmmaking is going.
Right.
Like you said, you have a platform that allows you to create tools for the individual roles on the set or on the production floor. If I'm a lighting guy, I need custom tools. I don't care about the animation tools. I just want lighting tools. Yep. Et cetera, et cetera. So
I need my gels for my filters and this and that, or whatever else is going on. What I also find fascinating, especially going, you know, because I've been talking to Ben about virtual production for years, and you know, he was mentioning, you know, talking about Unity for a while as well, is there's suddenly now, if you really pare down the tools that are only applicable to the person that's taking on that role, suddenly you can actually bring the person that takes on that role that may not necessarily be someone that's very techie or whatever, right? A fabulous DP may know a lot about cameras and stuff like that, but, you know, operating inside of a computer for virtual cameras may not be there. But you're able to use the tools to replicate everything that person, he or she, may need in there.
And
customize it even more to make it even easier for that person. I think that's a brilliant idea, is making custom tools. And suddenly now, you know, someone like Caleb Deschanel, who was the DP on Lion King, can just operate and basically is like, yeah, you know, being a DP is like playing a really cool video game.
Right? Yeah, no, exactly. And that was always the objective of that team, was being able to actually get whatever the dolly grip, who's been doing dolly for his entire career, come in and he's just running his grip. He's just doing the dolly the same as he always has, or he's a crane operator, and you have the way the crane behaves in the virtual world is identical. In fact, they had a real world crane there that they tied in all the sensors so they could extract the information they needed from it into the virtual sort of representation of it.
Right.
That is super fascinating. And I think that is just the tip of the bucket for where things are going. If you look at the stagecraft work that the ILM team has done, where you're starting to tie in LED screens and some of that work, there are where you no longer have to be wearing. That was the big downside, is like having to wear like a VR goggle or something, or stare at just a tiny display. You want to be able to have the actors as well in the same world, so they aren't having to imagine where they are. If they can actually look around and they literally are in whatever location, that's the ideal.
So this is interesting. I had this story. This happened. So I worked on Oblivion. For Oblivion, they had a set that they were doing for the house. Did you ever see the movie? Right. So they had the house, and they were, you know, there's a lot, because it's Joe Kaczynski and he's an architect, and he, you know, lots of shiny reflective stuff everywhere. Yeah, right. Yeah. And they decided, you know, because the environment outside had to change all the time, they were just going to put a bunch of green screen outside, and we're like, that's a terrible idea, because everything's so shiny and reflective.
Suddenly it'll be all green.
Yeah. And so what they did instead is not dissimilar, is they had this pre, like almost 270 degree screens outside, And they projected these skies that they captured in Maui, I think, or something like that, and they would put back there. And it looked beautiful inside, and you got all the natural reflections, et cetera. But I remember very specifically talking to Tom Cruise about it, and he goes, it was amazing. It was like I was there, and it changed my whole mood, feeling that instead of, you know, acting in front of a blue screen. So I think that that idea of enabling actors or the entire crew, for that matter, to be able to visualize much more clearly in a what they're experiencing instead of just trying to imagine it all in their head is a really that's what's great about real time, right? Is like you can see it. Oh, let's change it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's I think it's they talk about the happy accidents that happen on set where you like. You just play with things and suddenly like the right circumstances of whatever, that's what real time I think can really open or offer is it's in not just a pre-baked thing or you doesn't have to go through the whole VFX pipeline before you get the end result that you can have those tweaks or like, hey, let's just tweak the time of day. Maybe, okay, that's the feeling we're looking for. Like you never didn't know what you were trying to achieve before you went on set.
Yeah.
Those are kind of the things that real time, I think, really unlock. It's fascinating seeing a production like that come to life, where you can suddenly have these happy accidents.
I think it's really important that people see that, and I think, you know, there's a lot of things that was going on in CG that were inhibited that when you did. You know, there was an advantage of doing it in live action, right? Yeah. Live action, you could see it live. You could look at, like we just mentioned before, you move the light and there it is, right?
Yeah.
But you take that to real time and you have all that freedom, but then you have even more freedom. Like, no, move the sun over there. You can't do that.
So one of the other projects that I worked on was the Baymax Dreams projects for Disney Television Animation. And the director on the episodes was Simon Smith. Who comes from a live action background, and he had been at DreamWorks and PDI and done like a ton of CG work as well. But he kind of just repeated over and over that it, working in real time was like being on a live action set again. It kind of gave that same feel, even like working with the animators directly being out. It's like he's working with the actors on set because he can be, try this, try that, and like change the light, change the camera. Like he's literally being able to be that live action director again in the CG world. It was super freeing for him.
I think that's, you know, here's another thing that I think is important. And this comes from someone that's, you know, from the CG point of thing, is that if you suddenly give the actors something that's live or real time in some ways, then they have they can make a decision at that point. In fact, they're encouraged to make a decision at that point, which before they're like, whatever, we'll figure it out in post because it's just like, I can't imagine in my head right now and I just got to move on. So we'll just fix that in post. And we know that's been an ongoing joke of fix it in post. But now they're just, no, just do it right now. Yeah. Figure it out right now. Done? You like it? Okay, good. Decision made. And that saves you so much time and money, right?
Well, that's, I think the big thing is that you actually have the context to make the decisions. You have that where you aren't having to guess or just say, I guess that was close enough. I don't know. We'll have to see once it comes back from the vendor. Like it's such a, I think that's why the DPs and the filmmakers are so excited about this shift is you have that ability to do what they want. Like that's what their job is, to make those decisions, but they haven't been able to because it's such a slow process.
Well, they've always been dealing with this black box for a long time. You know, they make this film and then like, you know, 9 months later, they get to see what it looks like.
And it's the same with TV production as well. Like they spend so much time in storyboard and animatic, and then it gets shipped off and comes back and you're like, that's not what we wanted.
Being
able to actually iterate on these things is in that real time sort of world. And it doesn't actually preclude, like one common feedback I hear is, well, it's never going to be the same quality as offline. And it doesn't actually need to in my head, because you can have a representation of things in real time and still do the offline render. it's the same with open standards like USD and some of the other work that's coming down. You can actually have the exact same data set in your real-time world and the offline world. So you can still push it, everything to 11 in the offline world.
Yes.
And it doesn't preclude like having that pipeline. That's exactly what Ben and the team did for Lion King. They reproduced everything, and they were, so you could see the movie in real time, but then they sent it to the offline world for the, like the amazing fur and everything. Like that real time isn't going to be able to do, at least for a while. And then offline will still be 10 steps ahead because that never ending arms race.
Right. But let's go back to that a little bit, because I think this is an important thing. Like motion capture has been around forever. Exactly. Right. So, you know, that's, but virtual production is a little bit different, because virtual production is essentially motion capture, but you're motion capturing different things. You're adding a certain level that you didn't necessarily have back in the, you know, motion builder days. You're adding camera motion, which they had a little bit of, but now it's gotten more important, right? Yeah. I mean, really, if you think about what they did on Avatar, the only thing they changed that was different is they added a camera there.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's, you went from motion capture with motion capture plus camera, and you called that virtual production. But,
exactly. It's just one extra marker on the camera.
one extra marker on the set, and it's like, yay, now it's called virtual production.
Yeah.
But it did allow a different interactivity between the things, so you could see things a lot better. Now you started adding lighting, right? So suddenly something that Motion Builder didn't necessarily cover the same way that a game engine does is to do better lighting. Now, it's still not 100% ray trace, which is what people expect from feature films, or, you know, certain complexity or whatever. But, you know, you can see a lot.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you can compose your camera better. You can do better depth of field. You can do better other things. And so suddenly that DP who's looking at it happening starts to have more of a role in there. And I think that's really important.
Well, I think a lot of it is just that the game engines are actually starting to, like, they're using the same standards. So like all the lighting is physically based. We've got all of our cameras are physically based. All of the thing, like we're the technology is becoming sophisticated enough that the correlation is actually there. It's not just a random number in the game engine that's 12. What does that mean in a real world light? We're actually dealing with light temperatures. We're dealing with the same things that a lighting person on set would be working with. So correlation and the one-to-one sort of side of it becomes much more practical.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's so good, because I think that really does is now suddenly there's a motivation for people to use real world physics a lot more, right? Mm-hmm. And not just, you know, in terms of gravity and stuff, but also in terms of the way lighting really should look and the way a camera really should operate. And that's going to make it look more real. So,
And it's like, again, I still like there's certain things that you are only going to be able to achieve in an offline render. And I think that's probably going to always be the case. But what you can do in game engines is really, it's that giving you the context of what you're trying to accomplish. Like, is it even in the realm of possibility, or is it in the realm of what you were hoping for? And then you can have these side-by-side pipelines that are like the real-time, the same unified data kind of moving through both.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think there's going to be a different thing. What I think is interesting, actually, is, I mean, I've thought about this for ever since I started the Chaos Group, but the thing that I always been talking about with Vlado and with philosophy, I says, like, will real time replace offline rendering? And I actually think it will. It will eventually replace it, right? It's going to get fast enough. Now, we're always going to, the definition of what real time is always going to change, right?
Yeah.
You know, it used to be 24 frames a second. Now everyone's like, no, it's got to be 90 frames a second. There's a big difference between 24 and 90. It's significantly, it's almost four times more faster, right? So the definition of what real time is, but let's say it's 24. It's like, yeah, eventually most things will be able to render at that thing. But what's going to change, and I think this is, you know, we've hinted at this, is like, is the ray tracing, right? Ray trace, rasterized rendering is not replacing ray tracing. Ray tracing is going to replace rasterized rendering.
Yeah.
And right now, in terms of what you're seeing, a lot of real-time engines, you know, and stuff like with RTX cards, stuff that you're seeing in Unreal and in Unity, they are using ray tracing, but it's not 100% ray trace.
No.
It's rasterized rendering with some ray tracing on top.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the thing that we're...
certain layers or certain elements that are being replaced. Yeah.
And that's very useful to see. Like, you know, oh, at least I can see the reflection on the ground better, right? But it's not the real ray tracing, because we've been dealing with real 100% ray tracing since the beginning.
Yeah.
So that is something that is... that's our next frontier, I think, figuring out how to make that work.
I think an analogy on where ray tracing is, it's the same as when for the first 3D acceleration cards came out, where you would do like all your rendering for games was all software. And then suddenly we had a dedicated chip for 3D. So now we can suddenly do a lot more, and it kind of standardized and things became a lot more like things like OpenGL and some of these standards came out. RTX is at that baby step sort of layer right now. And I think it's not a matter of whether real-time rendering is going to be fast enough, is it's going to be good enough for a lot of applications. If you look like kids animation, like a lot of the stuff you see that's like kids TV shows, that's it's absolutely good enough for 99% of that. There's certain things with, like, again, it's mostly around furry creatures. That tends to be the one thing.
Yeah, fur or skin.
Yeah, fur or skin.
Skin is getting pretty good now, actually.
Yeah, it's mostly the fur when you get into the super advanced simulations. But again, there are things in the works on all the players. So, but for those kinds of CG animation productions, it's going to be good enough for... it's kind of like when digital came out for cameras. Like, is it good enough for like your soap opera on TV? Sure. Now suddenly it's good enough for everything.
It's better than film.
Yeah, exactly. So I think you'll see the similar thing with ray tracing or real-time rendering. It'll start creeping in here and there. Right now we're in the early adopter phase, but it'll become more, as the tools become more standardized, as the skill set and the knowledge of how to use the tools becomes more globally aware as the technology advances. It's definitely a huge transition for sure.
So let me ask you this, because you're the labs guy, right? And you're supposed to be thinking about 5 to 10 years down in the future. And what is the, so far what we've been talking about is how real time is basically helping mimic live action in a lot of ways, and how that's happening in that way. What is the thing? Do you think it's going to lead to something that's beyond that? Like, it's like, okay, now we can basically do films in virtual production, but is it going to change the way the kind of content we have? And you kind of hinted at, you know, live adapting the film or changing things, or like, what are some of the things that possibly real-time technology is going to enable happen for people?
I think the main answer is I look at how my kids consume content.
Okay.
It's not necessarily for folks like us who have been used to watching traditional linear productions, but my kids are like, they live in the Minecraft sort of user-generated YouTube world of like dynamic content. It's like everything's on demand or it's live streamed, or the audience is participating in the actual creation of the content. This is a whole new world for what it means to be a content creator. And real time is kind of, I think, the enabling factor for that. Like if a sandbox like Minecraft, where the world can be literally anything you want it to be. You extrapolate that to like, what is a user generated movie? Or we're watching a movie together and it recognizes us through whatever means, and it changes the story based on what types of movies we like, or what types of content we like, or what region of the world we're in. I think this is where the fact that it is real time, you can affect literally anything.
Okay, so do you think that there is a time in the somewhat future, could be distant future or not so distant future, where the movie or the content you are watching that is episodic or not episodic or whatever is rendering itself live instead of actually being pre-rendered and delivered?
I think there absolutely is that. I think it's it's coming probably sooner than you think. The Atom, for example, the Atom executable, there's a Atom episode 2, there's an executable you can download. You can watch it just like a linear movie, but at any point you can pause it, rotate the camera, look around, explore the set. Imagine if you were doing that for a Game of Thrones or something, where the super fans who are so into this content, like I always go back to The Mandalorian. Like I want to get, when I'm inside of his ship, I just want to pause it and look around and open up all those doors and like check out the stuff that he's collected in his world, his galaxy travels. Like the super fans of the IP that exist, they'll eat that stuff up. Another a good example is Chernobyl. When the Chernobyl document or that series came out, you saw the Google search spikes just go through the roof. Imagine if all of that, if that metadata, that contextual information was layered over the show. My wife and I were constantly pausing the show and being like, what is that real? Like, what did that actually happen? Like, being able to actually layer these, like for documentaries or anything. I think you suddenly be having that layer of interactivity. It isn't necessarily taking away the storytelling side of it, because that's kind of where I think the pushback would be, is I'm trying to tell my story. It's actually adding additional context or information on top of that, and really just kind of letting the audience consume the content the way they choose. Like how many people have watched this, their favorite movie, like dozens of times. The first time you watch it, it doesn't change, but the first time you watch it is probably, you're going to just consume it as a linear piece. But for each of the additional times, if there was Easter eggs or additional information you could find, suddenly it helps satiate that, like that reason why you're coming back to the content.
You know, it's funny because you say that, because I was, you know, because we're socially isolating ourselves to our houses, I installed Skyrim back on my computer. Now I haven't played that game in like 12 years, something like that, whatever. But I was like, you're exactly right. It was both nostalgic and experiencing it differently at the same time, you know? So I was like, oh, this is the Thieves quest. I remember this. This was so much fun and I'm going to do it again, but I'm going to do it slightly different, or maybe not in the same order, or maybe I'll take a pause and do something else. You know,
I'm just doing side quests this time. I don't care about the main storyline. Like,
And so you can sort of experience that. So it is strange to think of playing a game that's that massive and feeling nostalgic at the same time, you know?
But I think especially as more and more content moves to a CG sort of format, like you think of the Marvel movies, like I saw a stat, like 96% of the latest Marvel movie is CG. Like, so there's the actual actor, the non-digital part is such a small portion of it. Why shouldn't the audience be able to explore that? And why, like, I'm sure if there was an opportunity to go and check out I just want to hang out in the X set or the Avengers headquarters and just walk around. Like why as a super fan can't I do that? It's the content is digital, and if it is in this kind of, this is where I come back to the pipeline developer in me, is like, it's in this agnostic sort of format that we can have the real-time representation and the offline representation. Having that seamless transition from your hyper rendered like big blockbuster movie to a real-time representation on my phone suddenly becomes an achievable thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was, I don't know if you guys had it in Canada, but we had it here, and my son was playing it on Netflix, but there was a Minecraft
Minecraft show. Story mode.
Story mode, and you could choose your own adventure kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah, and so there was the Bandersnatch was the that was that spin-off there. I think the big challenge with the way that the current interactive content like that is done is they're just rendering. So one episode is 40 hours of footage. So because they aren't taking advantage of like what actual, like it's not real time.
Not doing it live.
It's not dynamically creating the content. Every branch is just exponentially adding to your budget, essentially.
Yeah. Although I bet you my Roku could possibly play Minecraft live or render.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. It's like your phone
doesn't take
like
much.
Yeah. Like the average phone nowadays has like, it's the equivalent of what that don't know, a PlayStation 3 or something. Like,
right.
So as the mobile technology, as like there's going to be certain platforms where I don't think it's going to be possible. Like my smart TV might not be able to render it because of the cost implications. You're not going to have that. But this is where also the things like GPU cloud rendering start coming in, where maybe I can render it in the cloud and actually stream. So I don't need the hardware on my side. The hardware is coming from,
or even closer, make it edge computing.
Yeah, an edge GPU compute, where it's dynamically assembling things as close as possible to the client.
You don't need to buy the $1,000 graphics card. You can just rent it for an hour.
Yeah, Google has their Stadia platform, which is meant to do the same thing for games. It may not make the question is whether it's going to be successful, but for games, maybe not, because people are used to having PCs or consoles. But for an entertainment platform like, say, Netflix, where you want the same experience on every device. Like, I watch Netflix on my phone. It's the same as my computer or my smart TV. An edge GPU compute type of rendering scenario would suddenly make a huge amount of sense.
Right.
There are, of course, cost implications right now. Like, GPU compute is pretty expensive and so on. But I think...
But, then again, so was the rendering engine when we talked it was $500,000.
Exactly. These are problems that will be solved as, the big cloud players are aware that this is a huge area of growth. Yeah. They're moving in this direction. So,
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Interesting times.
Yeah, interesting times. Right now, I think the whole world is a little bit on pause in terms of what's going on. But I think that all of that is great. And I think that the way that we consume content is really interesting. And I actually think even just the idea of, us being all isolated and seeing the kind of content that people are digesting in this situation is also very interesting. So I think that, when it comes to content creation, this is actually the golden age.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, if you look at like the VR remote collaboration, all these tools that we have access, suddenly, like if you're trying to make a movie remotely with people, that might be actually a thing that we're needing to do. Like, because movies are still needing to be made, even in these strange times. So who knows what kind of content will come out of the other side of this, where people are creating things in these multi-user VR collaborative worlds. Like, it's fascinating. I love hearing about it. And I spend far too much time checking out Twitter and seeing all the exciting things that people are doing and trying to avoid the rest of the news.
Well, good. That's some good news to follow. So hopefully people will listen to this and have some interesting inspiration by it as well.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, we've gone over an hour, and I know I'm sorry we had to sort of start over a little bit at the beginning. All good. But I really appreciate you coming on and talking about this, because this is something that's near and dear to me, and I'm thinking about it a lot. And I'm thinking that what's going on in the real time world is going to really change.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I love talking about it.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Mike. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.